Residents of more than half of Arkansas's counties don't have access to maternal care. We'll have more on what's being done to tackle the issue. The Arkansas Symphony Orchestra welcomes a new associate conductor, and NPR's Waylon Wong talks AI, bubbles, and how to make economics accessible. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the Natural State. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. A 2022 report from the March of Dimes shows nearly half of the counties in Arkansas qualify as maternity care deserts. That's defined as a county lacking access to birthing hospitals, birth centers, and obstetric clinicians like OBGYNs or midwives. The report finds 60% of maternity care deserts in the country are in rural counties. KUAF's Aiden Dixon reports.
Dr. William Greenfield has spent years working with mothers in Arkansas as a professor of OBGYN at UAMS and a medical director for family health at the Arkansas Department of Health. He says the challenge facing rural mothers starts with two basic issues.
So in Arkansas, we're talking around 35,000 births per year. And when you look in within our state, in terms of where the concentration of providers are, when you get to the rural areas of the state, you can certainly see there are large swaths of the state that may not necessarily have providers who are able to provide delivery services. So one of the challenges that our patients are going to face is just simply access to providers, because there's a relatively low number in certain portions of the state. That's one challenge. A second challenge that we would face is the number of delivering hospitals. The number of delivering hospitals has diminished over the past several years, and that creates a barrier as well.
Craig Wilson, the CEO of the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement, agrees that these are the relevant issues across a significant portion of Arkansas counties.
So those are a couple of the components that make up that maternity care desert. We know that, you know, as of 2022, there were about 10 Arkansas counties that had no OBGYNs. And, you know, we've lost nine labor and delivery services or hospitals with labor and delivery services since 2019. So there are more frequently going to be maternity care deserts.
But Dr. Greenfield says there is an important thing to keep in mind when these closures occur.
The need for that patient does not necessarily change. And, you know, one challenge, and I think one thing that has to be considered, is that the patients will see hospitals and hospital systems as a source of help in a time of need. And if someone is not attuned to what the changes are within their system, they may not necessarily know where to go.
It's in the traveling for that important healthcare that Wilson says the data collected and supplied by ACHI surprised him the most.
And it's not really that surprising, I don't suppose, but we're able to actually, you know, quantify the distance that women are traveling over time. So when a hospital stops labor and delivery services, and let's just say, for example, it's in Phillips County, and their median travel time to deliver the baby was in 2019, 6 miles. When that goes somewhere close to 40 or 50 miles, when that labor and delivery unit closes, we can actually quantify that. And we know from the evidence that for every half mile that they have to travel, it increases the risk for poor outcomes.
So here's the problem simply put. There's a lack of available maternal health care in much of rural Arkansas. So the question then becomes, what should mothers faced with the challenges of restricted maternal health care access do?
Planning in advance becomes of much greater import. If they're high risk, getting closer to a delivering hospital could also be an option for them. But frankly, there are very few options. You just don't know when the baby's going to come. So that's really what presents the challenge. I think, modeling something here in the state after what we've done with the trauma system for moms to be able to know what is available to them very quickly when that time comes, I think that's going to be important. And that's some, policymakers are certainly exploring that potential.
Dr. Greenfield says that from what he can observe, he is optimistic about the future.
Arkansas, we are, I think, at the cusp of having a very good impact on healthcare for the women and family of our state. There's, in the 20-some-odd years that I've been doing this, I don't think I've seen this broad of an interest or collective effort focused on women's health and improving healthcare for our patients. We have a number of committees and organizations across the state, ranging from large system-based organizations to community-based organizations that will have an impact on individual patients, they will have an impact on families and systems. And all of these things together, I think, should help to raise the standard of care and to improve the healthcare outcomes for the patients that we serve.
Though he says the road to get to that better future isn't cleanly laid out.
No silver bullets, no magic piece. It is a collective of, in some ways, everything, everywhere, all at once.
That was KUAF's Aiden Dixon reporting. Economics is an important, albeit sometimes dry, subject, but for public radio listeners, NPR's The Indicator from Planet Money takes an accessible, often humorous approach to explaining some pretty lofty ideas. Waylon Wong, one of the show's trio of hosts, spoke in Little Rock this week in an event held by Economics Arkansas. She caught up afterward with Little Rock Public Radio's Ashton Burgess.
What was one question or conversation from the audience that stuck with you?
I appreciated the question about AI, just because it's something that we think about a lot on the team, thinking about all the different ways that AI is disrupting the economy, reshaping it, and this really kind of meaty question of whether or not AI is a bubble, because I presented on this very quirky bubble from the early aughts in alpacas, and that was small and self-contained. The question of, is AI a bubble? And if it is, when are we going to start to see the bubble pop? I mean, that is a huge question that could have massive implications for the global economy. So I appreciate that people are thinking about it. And then when I met the person who asked the question later, I found out that she runs a trade school, basically. And so then that really got me thinking about all the interesting ways in which AI could be changing manufacturing, changing the way we think about education, and like which jobs are potentially AI proof and which ones are not. So it just kind of led to lots more curiosity for me.
So I kind of want to build off of what you just talked about with AI and the economic bubbles, but in terms of economic development. So there are communities like from across the country that have spent a lot of time trying to attract businesses and investment. So from your reporting, what separates the places that create lasting economic growth from those that simply land just a big announcement?
Yeah, I think that, and this actually goes back to when I was a reporter, a business reporter at the Chicago Tribune, is often you get these big press conferences and these big announcements about, oh, this company is moving their headquarters here, or they're opening a plant, or they're opening an office, and then you get like a ribbon cutting with like the governor and the mayor and whatever. A lot of times there's no follow-up, right? And so I think it's important for journalists to kind of check back after like a year or 2 years and be like, well, how many like net jobs were created? You collected these tax incentives. Did money kind of flow back to the community as was promised? Are they being good neighbors in terms of maybe environmental impact in an area? I think these are all questions that are incumbent on journalists to ask when you bring in new kinds of economic development. And right now, I think there's lots of interesting reporting going on around AI data centers and the community pushback, which you don't often see this. Like a lot of times I think these announcements get covered and I'm not sure if kind of everyday people pay that much attention, right? There's kind of economic development type announcements all the time, but So there's something about data centers that really has seemed to capture something in people, right? Like something visceral. And I think maybe because they are like these like hulking physical manifestations of this thing that's kind of scary and unknown, which is like, how is AI affecting me? And what's interesting in particular about the AI data centers is that I was just reading a report about one that's being constructed. It's a Meta data center that's being constructed in Louisiana. And right now it is leading to economic growth because you have people building it. And so they're spending money locally and there's money flowing in. But I think one big question is, how many jobs are these data centers ultimately going to create? Like when the construction crews go, then you just have these big buildings where you actually don't need a lot of people to staff them. They're just kind of rooms full of servers, right? And so, you know, what is this kind of economic development? Is it durable? Is it creating jobs? Is it actually raising the prosperity of an area? And I think with the AI data centers, at least we don't know yet.
That's really interesting. And I think in terms of the AI data centers and other economic development projects, they have generated, whether it be a lot of excitement or a lot of controversy, it's caused a lot of emotions because they are highly visible. So whether it be new buildings or factories or entertainment districts. So from your perspective, does visible investment necessarily mean local residents are benefiting economically?
I mean, not always, right? It's like you have a new business that opens, like who owns it? Is it a local business owner or is it a big corporation that's headquartered elsewhere? Is it a private equity firm? As journalists, business journalists, we're trained to kind of follow the money, right? And obviously like with a new business, if they employ local people, that is money that kind of comes back into the community, right? If you employ locals, but there's lots of different dimensions and ways to look at it. And it's like, let's say a company got tax breaks, right, to set up shop in a particular community, then you can look at what are the details of those tax incentives and does it actually kind of pay it forward for the community?
So one thing the indicator does really well is that it takes complicated economic issues and makes them feel relevant to everyday life. So I'm curious, what question are you currently asking about the economy right now that you don't yet have an answer to?
Well, we already covered one of the big questions, which is what the heck is going on with AI and is it a bubble? I think another big question we are wrestling with is the economy going to go into recession and what's going to happen with inflation? We're really focused on the labor market and we're really focused on prices and inflation. And these are kind of perennial things that we're looking at. But I think we're at a very interesting point right now where we have a new Federal Reserve chair who is saying that they're going to get inflation back down to the 2% target, but inflation's running like closer to 4%, right? So that's a huge job. And how are we going to get there, especially with gas prices still going back up and seemingly no resolution to the war in Iran? That's a huge question. And then this question of how is the labor market doing? How stable is the labor market? We've been talking for a long time about this kind of a stuck labor market where people aren't getting hired and they're also not getting fired, right? And so looking at those dynamics and where are the signs of weakness in the labor market? Are those being addressed? And what does it look like to be in an economy where potentially you have elevated inflation, but maybe not a lot of employment is another really big question.
And as someone who spends every day helping people better understand the economy, what is one economic question you hope more Americans start asking?
I think that it would be great if people asked, why are things the way they are? Because I think that you get this incredible sense of inertia in the economy. You're like, well, here's the system we have and here's how it works. And I'm just trying to figure out how to survive in this economy. But the economy was designed by people and none of it is inevitable. And so that's how I think about my job actually at Planet Money and at The Indicator is like, we are trying to expose the systems and the dynamics that make things the way they are. And I think that when you empower people with that information, then it gives them agency. It allows them to act. And so if you figure out that like the system was designed in a certain way and you're like, well, I don't like it, then you're empowered to make a different choice, to maybe change it, right? So I think it'd be great if everyone just started asking like, why is this the case? And getting curious about that stuff. And then if you don't like the way things are, then like, what can I do to shape an economy that works for me better?
That was Waylon Wong, host of The Indicator from Planet Money on NPR, speaking with Little Rock Public Radio's Ashton Burgess. And you can hear an extended version of their conversation online at littlerockpublicradio.org. The Arkansas Symphony Orchestra recently announced its new associate conductor. Northwest Arkansas native Matthew Pavone starts August 1st as the symphony's artistic leader and conductor of the Arkansas Symphony Youth Orchestra. Little Rock Public Radio's Paige Murphy sat down with Pavone to talk about his passion for music as a child and his aspirations for the ASO.
So what drew you to music and to being a conductor specifically?
Music was something that was a part of my early education. Probably started playing through school. Viola was actually the path that I took into music. So from there, I actually started playing in like a local youth orchestra. It was the Ozark Philharmonic Youth Orchestra. And there I encountered conductor David Barg, who was quite the personality. He was a exceptionally talented. He was eccentric. He was funny. And slowly over the course of, especially my high school years, it developed into, I actually love this. I love being here. I love the energy from the podium, from my friends, from this process of creating music. The most precise point I could like pin it on was the first time I heard Mahler's First Symphony. It was actually in Northwest Arkansas. I heard a live performance of Mahler's First Symphony, and I'd never heard Mahler's music ever before. And it just jumped out at me. We were sitting there I think it was their dress rehearsal. And this conductor I mentioned, David, had his score open, and he was pointing out the different locations, the different era, what instrument's about to come in, what does that represent? It's a motif from earlier in the symphony. All these sorts of details that, you know, I was never going to be privy to on a first time listen. And I was sitting there absolutely enthralled. And at the end of that rehearsal, he saw how excited I was. He closed the score, and on the like front cover he had everywhere he conducted it, there was a Moscow and Los Angeles Youth Orchestra, New York, any location he had done that symphony. And he closed the book and he handed it to me. He handed me the score. And he said, I just want you to take this and study it. Just hold on to it. And it was the most precious gift. I still have a photo of me holding that Mahler 1 score. I returned it after a year. I didn't want to keep it. It was too precious. And I returned it to him. But I think that's probably the most precise point where I was like, there's something magical about this art. There's something special about a conductor. I don't know what it is, but I knew from back then that that was the avenue I wanted to pursue.
I read that one of the reasons you went for this position was because programming is everything. Can you explain more?
I think that when anyone in their car is pulling up their playlist, right? Even if it's a podcast, I think it still kind of applies. There's something about this audio medium. We're generating something in our brains. I think that programming is an extension of kind of who you are as a person, just like anyone's personal playlist is kind of like, this is what I want to feel, or this is the music that I really enjoy. It's there's something intimate about it. And then when you share it, you know, if you've had the scary experience of being like, I really like this thing, I want to share it with someone, and there's the risk of maybe they won't like it as much as you do. And that there's a tension in that shared experience. I think that it is a personal thing, but it's also a reflection of who we are. And by we, I mean the whole community as a whole. It affects every single layer. There's not a single layer of the orchestra, symphony orchestra as a society that's not affected by what music we're doing, because it shows what our values are. It shows what inspires us. It shows what we hope to actually do later on in the future. And when I was seeing the programming that Arkansas Symphony was actually doing, I was actually astounded. I thought, this is exciting, because these are concerts I want to go see.
So you've had experience working with youth orchestras before. What's special to you about working with youth as opposed to adult musicians?
There's an energy. There's an excitement that we're still discovering a lot of things about life. And that discovery process doesn't end at any point, right? We're always learning. We're always growing as human beings. But I think that with young orchestras, young people in orchestras. There's so much excitement and discovery happening. And it was the point with which I fell in love with music. And I know what that feels like to be growing up, to be experiencing life, to not know what I'm going to do with my life yet. That's not even been decided. I'm just hanging out with friends. I'm doing my best in school. None of those other pressures were on me, and I freely chose to do music. Not because there was any, in my mind back then, there was no monetary gain. There was nothing. The pure draw was I love music and I love spending time with people. And that never changes at any point. I think that the energy that you get is very distinct just because of the age group.
What plans do you have for the youth orchestra or the symphony as a whole? Is there something specific you're excited about?
Yeah, I think there's a large learning curve for me, right? And joining in, because the hope is that I can join in into the vision that they have and be able to somehow bolster it. I think that in terms of like the youth orchestra, there's so much good that's already being done, and so to be invited into this organization already is such an honor. And I think with them, this is something I'm a big believer of too. I grew up listening to full length like classical albums all the way through. it's attempted. People can recognize the last 4 minutes of Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, right? People know Beethoven Fifth Symphony Movement One. Have they heard the rest of the overture? Have they heard the rest of the symphony? Are they familiar with his Fourth Symphony? All the other things. I think one of my hopes is, can we have this youth orchestra experience doing full length works, which they have absolutely before, but to aim for that, to aim for, instead of experiencing just movements, can we do a whole work? Give everyone in the orchestra that experience of understanding it's a part of a whole. It's one chapter. One movement is just one chapter in the book. I think those are the things I'm really excited to maybe explore. So I just hope to come alongside them with what they're already doing, and with the Youth Symphony, I'm hoping that we can find a way to have both our classics, our pillars, and maybe offer something that people have not heard before. I think that's really exciting to do.
Can you pitch going to the symphony to someone who's never been?
So my pitch, basically, for anyone who hasn't been, is there is something here for you. And I would love to help anyone find what that is. Please go online. Please see. Are you interested in movies? Are you interested in this or that? Whatever it might be, there is something here for you. And this is what I was saying before. Programming is a reflection of us, and it's what we think the community will resonate with too. So I think that's it, is that Arkansas Symphony Orchestra is going to be doing music that you will find meaningful.
That was Matthew Pavone, the new associate conductor of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, speaking with Little Rock Public Radio's Paige Murphy. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode online at littlerockpublicradio.org. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.